German business confidence soars while U.S. consumer confidence sinks. Britain's second quarter growth, strongest in 4 years, fueled by private investment. In the U.S., companies are sitting on nearly $1 trillion in cash, but aren't hiring new workers. About the only thing propping up our economy is government spending. So what's wrong with this picture? Good morning. It's 6 after 9. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. Why are things better in Europe right now than they are in the United States? That's the question we'll try to get answered this hour with your help and the help of two guests. We'll start with Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek, a columnist for Slate and author of Pop, Why Bubbles Are Great for the Economy and Dumb Money. Then at around 9:30, I'll be joined by Robert Reich, professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and former U.S. Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. Dan Gross, good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Well, for the moment, things appear to be better in Europe than in the United States. Are they really better? And if so, why is that happening?
Well, you know, Europe is now a big place. You pointed to the optimism in Germany. Germany is the biggest economy in Europe. They are a export-driven economy, and they're doing quite well. But I don't think you would find that similar confidence in Ireland or Spain or Greece or many other components of the European Union and the European community. So I think if you look at the overall growth numbers for all of continental Europe versus the U.S., we're actually doing a little better. Europe seems to have dodged some bullets. Remember, there was all this talk of Greece defaulting on its debt, and then Spain. They've done the bailouts. They have just done stress tests for the banks. And that is that combination of kind of swift, big action by the European Central Bank, which is, you know, bailouts and the guarantees of the government debt, and the stress tests, which we saw happen in the U.S. in 2009, is having a similar effect on confidence. In other words, Europeans and investors are not freaking out as much over the prospect of that whole financial system melting down.
One of the things I noticed, and I mentioned it in the introduction to the program, is that in Britain, private investment is kind of leading the way there, at least for now, while in the U.S., our whatever job creation we've had has largely been stimulated by government spending. What are the British companies seeing or looking at that companies in the U.S. are not?
Well, one of our issues is that we have, I think there are two things going on in the U.S. One is a lot of excess capacity, and by that I mean, you know, too many factories, too many houses, too many stores, stuff not being used. Capacity utilization, which tells you the percentage of all your, you know, factories and stuff that are being used. You know, a year ago it was at 68%, now it's at 74%. You know, historically it's usually at about 80%. So people feel like as long as there's so much empty stuff, as long as there's so many empty office buildings, apartment buildings, factories, stores, why build, why invest in new capacity? You know, a lot of planes were taken out of service because passenger traffic down, a lot of trucks and a lot of rail cars were taken out of service and are sort of sitting idle. So there's this sense that there is, you know, a lot of capacity for all sorts of things going on, and so you don't need to invest in new capacity. And that is one of the things you might expect to happen, you know, when we suffered a fall. The recession we had, basically in the last 25 years, we've had two recessions before this one, and they each lasted about a year, and they were very shallow. The recession we just had was very deep and long, and the economy was shrinking at a 6% annual rate for a couple quarters there. And so there was a pretty big fall-off in demand. So people felt like, you know, I need 100 stores. Hey, now I only need 90 or 80. I need this much office space. So I think there's a kind of shell-shocked sense among American companies that there's still too much excess capacity in the U.S. and not enough demand. The second thing that's going on is that, you know, growth is going on outside our borders, Latin America, China, Asia, Africa. And U.S. companies, the bigger ones, are getting in on that. And so even when they start to invest, these big cash piles they have, a lot of that investment is going to be taking place outside our borders. That's good for shareholders. That's good for bondholders. It's good for government. GM is now making more cars in China than it makes in the U.S., so our prospects of getting paid back really rest on good growth there. But that doesn't always do a whole lot for, you know, employment growth locally.
Well, it becomes a sort of catch-22, though, doesn't it, for our economy? I mean, if companies aren't going to hire people back, who's going to buy, who's going to take up that excess capacity?
Exactly. And so that is why, you know, there have been calls for more stimulus for the Federal Reserve and for Congress and the White House to try to do more to boost demand. But I should also note, I think, you know, we often see this kind of global growth as a zero-sum game. Close down a textile plant here, it opens in Asia. Or Disney is building a new theme park in Hong Kong, they're not building a new one here. But the U.S. economy is really open to the world in ways that, you know, many other economies aren't. And when you look at foreign direct investment, which is the, you know, amount of money that foreign companies are buying in, you know, are they buying factories, are they buying companies, are they buying industrial capacity, the U.S. leads the world in that. Last year, $150 billion came in from overseas. It's running about 10 to 15% higher so far this year. There are a lot of transactions that involve Brazilian, Indian, Chinese, Japanese, Italian companies buying American companies and putting people to work, making investments that way. A second way in which we are participating in growth is through trade. Exports are up more than 20% year over year. They plummeted after September 08. They are now almost back to pre-crisis levels. They've been growing, you know, I think the most recent month in May, about $150 billion. So if you are in agriculture, if you make Boeing airplanes, if you export services, you know, we export, tourism is an export, healthcare is an export. When people come here to go to college, that's an export. The fact that there's a lot of this growth and profits being made overseas means some of it is flowing back here, and I think we have to get better, especially as small businesses, in participating in that global growth. I don't think it's all doom and gloom.
Well, the headline at the top of the money section of USA Today for this past Monday was Economist Optimism Wanes, and it was talking about the quarterly report. It was sort of a survey of economists. What do they think? What are their best guesses? And between April and July, the mood shifted quite a bit. And one of the biggest worries was jobs. And I keep coming back to this, but ultimately, you know, we can talk in the abstract about how this investment or that investment benefits companies, but you still have millions of people who are out of work, who are losing their homes, who may be running out of their unemployment. And we're now looking at predictions that we won't get the jobs back that were lost in the recession until 2014 or later. We're looking at a very, very troubled next few years for a lot of people. There's still a lot of pain out there. And, how does business respond to that, or just doesn't it matter?
There's no question that, you know, when you look again at the velocity of the downturn and the number of jobs we lost, 7.2 million, I think, we're down from the peak. We have a long way to go, which is why, again, people have been arguing for bigger stimulus from the beginning, more stimulus, and I'm definitely in that camp. If I were a policymaker, whether I was at the Fed or in the White House or in Congress, I would be running around figuring out ways in which we can put people back to work and kind of jumpstart growth, because unless we get greater growth and better job growth, we're not going to solve all these other problems. You know, growth is a kind of miracle cure for the deficit. When the economy grows better than they expected, tax receipts come in better than expected, and you don't have to spend as much money on social welfare programs, and voila, the deficit shrinks without you having to make any painful decisions. And so it is a bit of a mystery, to me, why there is not a greater sense of urgency either at the Federal Reserve or in the, you know, in the White House and the Democrats in Congress. I understand why the Republicans are not too eager to do anything else. They think it's to their political advantage. Some of them are philosophically opposed to the government doing stimulus, although they weren't opposed when there was a Republican in the White House. But there is this level of complacency. And I don't, you know, there have been various explanations. Is it because they are cowed by all this talk of deficits and they've made the calculation that, hey, they're better off with higher unemployment rather than higher deficits going into the midterm election? Is it a class issue? You know, are all these people in Washington where the unemployment rate is very low, they don't know people who are struggling, so they don't really empathize or feel it? I'm afraid I don't have a good answer. I've written sort of several columns sort of questioning why there seems to be a sort of blasé attitude about unemployment, and I'm not sure I have the answer.
Well, I mean, you had people who would probably identify themselves as Republicans saying that the stimulus has made things worse. And, you know, so there's
yes,
certainly
that,
a
that
number
is,
of...
I mean, with respect, that's that's something of an insane statement to make. You know, first of all, a third of the stimulus was tax cuts, which Republicans are always and in every instance favor. The study just came out from Mark Zandi, who's the chief economist at economy.com, who was one of John McCain's economic advisors, and I believe Alan Blinder. And, you know, they did their best objective measure of what would have happened if we had not done any of the stimulus and had we not done all these programs. And, you know, their contention is that things would have been much, 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 much worse. I don't think that's an ideological. You know, the stimulus worked, and combined with what the Fed was doing and the bailouts and all those guarantees and all those things that are very unpopular, they helped stop the panic and put some money into the system that wasn't coming elsewhere. So, I think it's very – there are people who say it made things worse, but, you know, if you believe that tax cuts are what stimulates the economy, again, 30 to 40% of what was in the stimulus was in the form of tax cuts. So that stuff made – you know. Those tax cuts made things worse. I don't think that's a serious case.
We need to get some callers in on this program pretty quickly. Let me give the phone numbers, and we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We've already got people calling in. 800-642-1234 is the number to use to join the program. 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can go to the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page and leave a message for us there as well. And we'll try and share as many of those as we can during the course of the program. Dan Gross is my guest until about 9:30. He's a senior editor at Newsweek, also a columnist for Slate. He's got a couple of books out, Pop, Why Bubbles Are Great for the Economy, and his most recent book just out, is called Dumb Money, and I intend to ask him about that title before we get to the half hour. Anyway, your calls coming up in just a moment. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 20 after 9. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. After 2 on Talk of the Nation, authors talk about why they write, plus the heat of the current wedding season. Amy Dickinson of Ask Amy talks about getting cold feet. That's coming up later on. This hour, we're talking about the economy. And my guest in this portion of the program, senior editor for Newsweek, Dan Gross. He's also a columnist for Slate. He has a couple of books out, Pop, Why Bubbles Are Great for the Economy, and his most recent work, Dumb Money. We have callers who want to join us. Let's go to the phones and take a call first from Adam in Prentice. Adam, good morning.
Good morning to you and your guest. I want to make it clear from the start, I'm an independent, and what I noticed is that in 2008, the Democrat Party, which is the one I tried to reach out to, showed very little to zero interest in doing anything to head off this recession in the first place, because I think they felt that a bad economy was a campaign issue that inured to their benefit, that they could use to beat the Republicans over the head with and get their candidate, Mr. Obama, elected to the presidency. And my example for this is that fully 9 months before Wall Street tanked and the economy started losing jobs, I went to one of those talking sessions with Representative Obey from Northern Wisconsin. I explained to him that my four-year degree from Madison was in economics. The term I used was, I said, I am very, very scared about what is going to happen to the American economy. I told him personally to his face that I thought that millions of Americans were going to lose their homes due to foreclosure if something wasn't done about this. And I also got him started by telling him what Franklin Roosevelt had done with the government in an analogous situation. And Representative Obey was very complimentary to me in every way, but obviously didn't do anything. So right from the start, he was the most powerful member of Congress. You know, he ran the committee that appropriated all the money that went through the Congress. But then after that, we saw the Obama administration have a so-called stimulus plan that was rather anemic, rather ineffective. I'm a fan of Keynesian economics, which I believe every reputable PhD economist would be. But then after that failed, the Obama stimulus, then we wasted a year debating this healthcare plan. So we had another lag where there was no stimulus to the economy. And I think we're at a point now where it's too late. I think when the economy tanks, you have to use Keynesian economics right away. You cannot wait 2 years after the event and hope that it will work.
Adam, thanks for that. Let's get Dan Gross's response to that.
Well, I think, you know, there has been a school of thought. If you read Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, who's a columnist for the New York Times, he was saying from the beginning in January 2009 that the $787 billion stimulus that was designed to roll out over 3 years was simply too small, that given the output gap, given the shrinkage we had in the economy and the difference between the amount we were actually producing and the amount that the economy has the potential to produce, that it should have been something on the order of $1.3 trillion, you know, 50% bigger. And he was saying that it was, you know, too small from the beginning. Of course, you know, there is a political reality, and the political reality is that in order to get the stimulus passed, and basically in order to get three votes of Republicans, Olympia Snow, Susan Collins, and George Voinovich of Ohio, the Democrats had to agree to reduce the size of the stimulus. They weren't pitching a $1.3 trillion, but they were talking, you know, 900 or maybe a trillion. And it came down because of they wanted to get these extra votes, and that was sort of the price. So there is a school of thought that says, you know, this was doomed to failure from the beginning because they weren't sufficiently bold. And that things in the first and second quarter of 2009, of course, turned out to be worse than expected, so we got in a deeper hole. And I think there is a lot of truth to that. The question is, you know, was there some alternative scenario whereby a larger stimulus could have been passed? And to me, the answer seems, you know, no. And given the way things went since then, I mean, there's essentially a situation where virtually no Republican will vote for anything that a Democratic president and majority proposes, that they filibuster pretty much everything, and that there are a few Democrats like Ben Nelson of Nebraska who are, you know, willing to join them, so that they're, you know, they're not effectively governing. So if you asked, you know, the economic team at the White House what they would like to do now, they would give you a list of things, but I don't think any of them are feasible politically. I mean, as the caller notes, we are already pretty much in August. The midterm elections are in November. We have a couple more months of data. At this point, you know, it's too late to do anything that will significantly impact the direction of the economy before those elections.
Adam, thanks for the call. Let's hear from Peter in Kingston next. Peter, good morning.
Good morning. My question to you is about loan to value. I remember it was like 92 or maybe 93 when I was working in the banking system. It was a 80%. Loan to value, and then they went to 85, and then to 90, and then when they got to 90, I started to think to myself that there's something seriously wrong here, because that gap, that 80% loan to value, gave a little bit of a cushion in case there was fallout, but then they went to 115 and 120, and then the debt-to-income ratio started to change. And it just set us up for, I mean, I'm not an economist, but I could clearly see this was setting us up for a huge fall, and what we were living on was just expectation. It was very high expectation, but that's what we were living on. I was wondering if I'll take my comment off the air.
Dan Gross?
Yeah, you know, it's that. In fact, you mentioned I did this book last year called Dumb Money. The subtitle was How Our Greatest Financial Minds Bankrupted the Nation. That kind of recklessness, the lowering of standards, taking things down, lending more, was not just evident in housing. It was evident in, you know, commercial loans. It was evident in lending for office towers. It was evident in lending to private equity firms. It was a collective, global lowering of standards where they said, you know, we can sell off any loan we make, therefore we can make any loan, and everybody can hedge their risk. And if we just have endless growth, then you don't have to worry about the underlying asset values because they're just going to go up. And so that clearly is, you know, the root of the problem. But, you know, people think that it was just in housing. It wasn't. You are seeing the fallout in, again, you know, people that were buying portfolios of office towers with no money down hoping to flip them, people that were buying entire companies. This
people
was
that were buying radio and television.
A collective virus of bad lending.
Well, and isn't the real root of this slavish worship of the current quarter? I mean, we seem to be really stuck. We can't think more than 13 weeks out. And anything that makes me money today, this afternoon, in fact, 5 minutes from now, is good. And if I have to think about, well, what's that going to mean 2 years from now? Well, that's, well, forget that. I mean, I have a good friend who's a chief financial officer for a large international corporation, and he, one of the things that bothers him the most about his job is he said, you can't do anything that's even remotely strategic. We're always slaves to the current quarter.
There was definitely a short-term or short-sightedness going on, but I also think with lending, it was about an embrace of a new technology. You know, when we latched onto the Internet and the dot-coms, we just thought it was this new thing that would change the rules of everything and change the way you invested. The technology that people latched onto in the last decade with lending was securitization, this idea that instead of making a loan and holding onto it, you sell it off to somebody, and then they trade it, and then they hedge their debt, their risk against it, and everybody comes out happy. You know, I've profiled a couple of bankers who did really well in the recession, and those were the ones who all throughout this agreed to basically hold on to every loan they make. And when you know you're going to be holding on to it, you make smart loans. You require people to put money down. You do the underwriting. If you know you're going to be stuck with it, you're more careful. And I think that is one of the great lessons of this debacle.
Dan Gross, I'd love to have you on for a full hour sometime. I think it would be a real interesting conversation.
Okay, anytime.
Appreciate your being here this morning. Dan Gross, senior editor for Newsweek, columnist for Slate, author of a couple of books, Pop, Why Bubbles Are Great for the Economy, and Dumb Money. Thanks a lot to Dan Gross for being on the program this morning. Chrissy Pease, good job in booking this guest. Coming up, I'm going to be talking, we'll spend the rest of the hour talking about this topic. The genesis of this was an article that appeared in Reuters, I believe it was, saying, hey, things are great in Europe, not so hot in the United States, what's going on? And that's where this started. Obviously, it's not where it's going to finish, but we'll keep on talking about this in the rest of this hour. You'll have a chance to talk with Robert Reich, who was Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. He's currently a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He'll be joining us in just a moment. You'll have a chance to talk to him. Here's how you get in touch with us. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. The email address, talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. And there's a Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page where you can leave a message and we will turn that into analog radio waves for you. We'll convert from digital to analog. Isn't that quaint? My guest joining me by telephone now is Robert Reich, professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and former U.S. Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. Professor Reich, good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Well, good morning, John.
The headline in the money section of Monday's USA Today was "Economist Optimism Wanes," while that same day, the lead economic story from Reuters said Europe's prospects brighten as U.S. fades. The question we're trying to get at this hour is why?
For one thing, the United States economy is having a very, very difficult time getting out of the doldrums. We are very dependent, John, on U.S. consumers. 70% of our economy is based on consumer demand. And the fact of the matter is, American consumers are still in very difficult shape. I mean, most of us are still trying to come out from under a big debt load left over from 2007, 2008. Most of us can no longer use our homes as essentially ATM machines, using the rising value of homes as collateral for the loans we used to be able to get pretty readily. Because our home values are much lower than they were in 2007 after the bursting of the housing bubble. And many of us, for good reason, are worried about keeping our jobs. The official level of unemployment is not only very, very high, but it understates the true level of unemployment. Most middle-class families, most families across the board, are dependent upon two incomes, and at least one of those incomes these days is threatened by loss of job or is dependent upon commissions or contracts that are just not coming in. So for all these reasons, American consumers are not spending, and that means the American economy is not coming out of the doldrums.
There was a report that came out this week that says U.S. companies are sitting on $837 billion in cash. It's money that they've basically stuffed in a mattress. I mean, they're not even earning interest on it. And they're not hiring. They're not putting workers back to work. It seems to me that if we want consumers to spend, they have to have jobs.
Yes, but this is the chicken and egg problem that haunts the economy right now. American companies, big ones, are not going to hire until they know that there are consumers out there for the goods and services they have to sell. They will be going abroad. In fact, GM, for example, now sells more cars in China than it does in the United States. That would be okay if GM was exporting those cars from the United States and creating jobs here in the United States for American workers, but that's not the case. GM, like many big global companies headquartered in the United States, is actually building the cars, at least most of the cars it sells in China, there in China. There are 32,000 Chinese working for GM right now. Meanwhile, GM's own labor force in the United States is down to about 55,000 or 53,000. And that's way, way down from what it used to be. I don't mean to pick on GM. This is the case for many, many companies. Other companies like GE, for example, are basically using technology to slim down. And are not investing their cash pile. They are buying back their stocks. They feel that the best way of raising the value of their shares is to simply buy many of them back and award dividends. And indeed, GE share price is going up, even though GE is not expanding, almost not at all.
Well, I guess by contrast, in Great Britain, their economic growth, which is said this quarter, said to be the best in 4 years, their economic growth is being led by private investment. What's different in Great? What are they seeing in Great Britain that we aren't seeing here in the United States?
Well, all of Europe, including Britain, is dependent more on exports. Exports to other European countries, exports to Canada, United States, Latin America, and increasingly exports to China and India. And secondly, Britain took a big dive, in fact, as deep a dive as we did, but Britain was never as dependent, and I suppose this relates to my first point, as British consumers, as we are to, dependent on American consumers. So the British economy can revive even if British consumers still are discouraged. And thirdly, Britain never endured the huge debt bubble that we did. British consumers and British businesses never went nearly as deeply into debt as we did. We're still deleveraging is the official title or the official term. Many American consumers and certainly small and medium-sized businesses are deleveraging in terms of just getting out from under debt, paying off those debts to the extent that they can. British consumers, British citizens, never had quite that degree of debt.
Neither did the Canadians, as near as I can tell. They didn't have the banking problems that we did there either.
Canada didn't suffer nearly the same degree of indebtedness, consumer debt, housing debt, mortgage debt, to the extent that their financial system was different from ours, and there are some differences. Canadian banks did not go into the wild, risky derivative market the way that the United States banks did. And another thing needs to be brought up, John, and that is that because the United States middle class, as opposed to, say, the Canadian middle class, really needed to borrow in order to maintain its standard of living, because so much in the United States of the total income of Americans was going to the top 1% by 2007. That meant that here in the United States, consumers, even though the total capacity of the economy was growing dramatically, the typical consumer could only keep up that living standard by borrowing more. Whereas in Canada and many other countries that have a more equitable distribution of income to begin with, the middle class simply didn't have to borrow as much in order to maintain its standard of living.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because that leads directly into what I want to talk about after the break, and that is Tim Geithner came out the early part of this week, Monday, I think it was, and talking about the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, and I'd like to get your take on that when we come back. And I also want to invite callers to join the program, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, Robert Reich is my guest in this half of the program, professor of public policy at UC Berkeley and former United States Secretary of Labor. You can ask him questions about our economy at 800-642-1234. The email address, talk@WPR, and we'll have we can have comments from Facebook as well. The Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page is the place to go for that. And we'll be right back. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 9:41. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Next hour, my guest recounts one of the most elaborate deceptions of World War II, a plan to disguise the impending Allied invasion of Sicily framed around the body of a dead man. It was Operation Mincemeat. And we'll talk to somebody about that after 10 o'clock, I hope. This hour, it's the economy. And the genesis for the program, an article that came out in from Reuters titled Europe's Prospects Brighten as U.S. Fades. That's where this started. It's clearly going in a lot of different directions. My guest, Robert Reich, professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and former United States Secretary of Labor. And Professor, before the break, I said I wanted you to comment on the looming expiration of the Bush tax cuts. What do you think ought to happen? Tim Geithner says it's okay to let them expire, at least the ones on the very richest people. What do you think that Congress ought to do with this?
Well, first of all, it's very important that we acknowledge that the American middle class However you define it. I mean, some people define it as being anywhere from $20,000 of income per year up to $150,000 or even $200,000. I mean, it's most people in this country. Let's acknowledge that the American middle class is still very much in trouble. And so a tax, effectively a tax increase on the American middle class would not be a good idea, given that they're already having difficulty making ends meet. That means that we do not want the Bush tax cuts to expire for most people. The real question, and it's a really more of a political question than it is an economic question, is whether we let the Bush tax cuts expire for the top, essentially, 1.5% to 2% of income earners who are earning over $250,000. I think it probably is a good idea to let them expire because it's important to send a signal that we are concerned eventually about the structural deficits, about those big deficits way out there that are going to be out there when the economy recovers and that will be even bigger if the economy doesn't recover. But the people at the very top, the top 1.5% of income earners, are not going to be deterred from buying simply because their taxes go from 36% to 39%, marginal taxes. I mean, those marginal taxes were much larger, for example, years ago, and it didn't deter them from buying. After all, being rich means you don't have to worry about much of anything. You can buy as much as you want. That's the colloquial definition of being rich. You buy what you want. So from the standpoint of economics, it's not a problem to raise taxes or essentially end the Bush tax cuts for the very rich. Politically, though, it's going to be a battle. And I don't see right now where either side, either politicians who want to keep the Bush tax cuts going for the middle class, or those who want to keep them going in addition for the very wealthy, will have the 60 votes they need in the Senate to do it. The easiest and unfortunately most automatic way of handling this is to simply let them expire for everyone, and I think that's probably what's going to happen.
There was an article that came out earlier this week in one of the major papers. I forget which one it was now. I don't have it in front of me. But basically it said that the middle class was disappearing. We were losing the middle class. And as you mentioned earlier, the middle class, in order to stay the middle class, in the 80s and the 90s and into this decade, had to borrow more and more money just to maintain that standard of living. What happens to the United States if the middle class really does kind of disappear?
John, this has been a problem, a challenge, a paradox for many years. It started really in the late 1970s when the typical wage of the person right in the middle of the wage ladder started to flatten out instead of continue to grow as it had through the late 40s, 50s, 60s, and early 1970s. That flattening was something new. Particularly in light of the fact that the U.S. economy kept on growing. Usually, when the economy kept growing and productivity kept improving, we saw middle-class wages continue to rise. But that was not the case starting in the late 70s, continuing through the 80s and 90s, and right on through 2007, when finally the Great Recession took place. The middle class had to resort to various what might be called coping mechanisms to keep their standard of living intact, to maintain their buying in the face of flat or, in many cases, declining wages. First of all, women went into the paid workforce in big numbers. Secondly, most people worked longer hours. By the year 2000, Americans were working typically 350 hours a year, more than the very industrious Japanese or the Europeans. And then the final coping mechanism was to borrow. And we've seen that that borrowing was based upon the assumption that housing prices would continue to rise, an assumption that proved disastrously wrong. And so when that borrowing bubble, that debt bubble, burst in 2000, really at the end of 2007, most middle-class houses and homes and families were left with no more coping mechanisms, no more ways of maintaining their assumed standard of living, expected standard of living, expected because the entire economy was growing, in light of the fact that their own wages were not growing. And that's really an underlying problem. The American middle class is under assault. Middle class wages have not risen. Partly it's because of globalization. Partly it's because of technological change that has taken away a lot of middle class jobs. We'll discover, I think, when the Great Recession is completely over, when jobs come back, and I think that they will come back, but the problem is we'll discover that many of those jobs pay less than the jobs that people had before. They will be in retail or restaurant or hospital, hotel, child care, elder care, a lot of service jobs that involve personal attention, but don't provide very much pay or very much economic security. And that, over the longer term, is one of the biggest problems we face.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Rick in Madison next. Rick, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Yes, good morning. My question relates to tax policy. I agree exactly what you were saying about income stagnation, but we always hear that low taxes encourage more private investment and that the economy should grow, but we almost have an opposite of that where we have high taxes in Europe and stronger private investment growth. And I'm wondering if what your thoughts are on tax policy and also tax policy and basically health care, social health care safety net, how that affects consumer sentiment and encourages consumer spending.
Rick, the big difference, and I think you're alluding to it, and I talked about it before, is that in Europe, you have much greater and consistent consumer demand. Consumer demand, and I want to really emphasize this, is one of the central driving forces in an economy. And whether you like consumerism or not, and I think that we... Personally, I think we spend far too much on filling our homes with stuff, and not nearly enough attention is being paid to our social goods, public goods like the environment or public transportation or education. Now, put that to one side for a moment. It's clear that in Europe, because there is more of a safety net, and because consumers can continue to spend because of that safety net, there has not been nearly as much of a downturn as there has been in the United States. The high taxes in Europe versus the relatively low taxes on corporations and investors here really are not the key differential. As I said before, American corporations are sitting on a huge pile of cash right now. It wouldn't make any difference whether their taxes went up or down in terms of corporate taxes. The real difference has to do with consumer demand. Those American corporations are not going to invest in new capacity, in more jobs here in the United States, if they don't feel that there are consumers out there in the United States to purchase what they have to produce.
Rick, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Michael in Blue Mounds. Michael, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Michael.
Hi. My comment was, you sound surprised when China had only 32,000 workers and America had 55,000. Shouldn't that be reversed if China is selling more cars than we are?
Well, Michael, right now, GM is still in the United States producing cars, not only for the U.S. market, which is still pretty good, but also for some exports. But remember that 52,000 figure in terms of GM auto workers in the United States is down from something in the order of 500,000 workers not that many years ago, 10 years ago, whereas China's 32,000 GM workers is way up. In fact, just a few years ago, at the last time I looked, was about 5 years ago, GM had almost no workers in China at all. So if you look at the trend lines, you see that the fact that GM is producing more cars in China is almost inevitably going to result in a few years in GM having more Chinese workers than American workers. I don't want to, again, pick on GM, and I don't want to suggest that that asymmetry that I just referred to is the key variable, but it does indicate, I think, something that is very important. American-based corporations, big ones like GM, are rapidly becoming global corporations that have no particular linkage to the United States economy or to American workers or to even American investors. These global corporations will go where the markets are, and also where they can get the most productive and cheapest inputs, including labor inputs.
Michael, thanks for the call. Ruth in Portage, you'll be next. Ruth, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Now you're having a senior, really senior leader make a comment here. Enjoying your program very, very much. I wonder, one thing first, talking about what our labor expects. I think our political parties, for one thing, both of them should get together and start doing a little compromising instead of pulling each other apart all the time. I'm also concerned on this stimulus money, are we actually making more people depending or dependent on always getting a handout of money? I don't know, but are three-fourths of the people not wanting any manual labor to do things? Do they want to sit behind the desk and get all this money? Another thing I think is really important with all of these people that are hurting, that don't have the pensions or income of a lot of people or that is set every month, can we cut our means of spending? Are we wasteful in so many areas? Do we have to have all the technology for our kids and that? Can we lower a little bit of the things that our families have and still enjoy life?
Well, Ruth, you raised a whole host of extremely good questions, and let me get to them as quickly as I can. Your point about both parties should get together, I couldn't agree more. This kind of polarization is hurting America, and I believe that most intelligent, reasonable people should be able to see that certain things need to be done, whether we're talking about better education for our kids or making sure that our infrastructure in this country is up to par, or making sure that the long-term, not short-term, but the long-term deficit is under control. But polarization is hurting us. We can get back to the question of how to overcome that. But your second point, stimulus money making people dependent on handouts, I take issue with. Most people these days who are collecting unemployment insurance would much rather have a job. Unemployment insurance pays a small fraction of what they could earn in a full-time job. And about half of the people in this country who are without jobs don't even qualify now for unemployment insurance. So our social safety net is in tatters. Your third point about labor and the market for jobs, isn't it, you know, why don't we cut our spending? Why don't we simply get by with less? Is right, I think, in value terms, although there are many lower middle class and poor people in this country who are still having a hard time earning enough to put together for themselves what most of us would consider a minimally decent standard of living. On top of that, we do have many things we need to do in this country. I alluded to parks, recreation, education, social services, better infrastructure, making sure that the environment is better taken care of. Well, we cannot do that unless the economy grows. And that's why economic growth is so important, not simply for the sake of making more stuff and filling our homes with it, but also, importantly, for making sure that we have the capacity as an economy to generate a lot of public goods, such as a clean environment and better education and better public health that will make us all far better off in the future.
Thank you. Thank you for the call. We're just about out of time. I don't want to take another call and open up another line of inquiry. Closing thoughts, Professor Reich. I realize there's no magic bullet for this thing, but what would be one thing that Congress could do if they could get their act together that would help to get us on the right path here?
Well, one thing, John, it's a relatively small thing, but I think Democrats and Republicans could both agree to this, and that would be to come up with an exemption, to exempt the first $20,000 of income from payroll taxes for 2 years, a kind of payroll tax holiday on the first $20,000 of income. This would, I think, be satisfying to Republicans because they like to style themselves as tax cutters. But it would also be important for Democrats and others who understand that the economy needs to be stimulated by people who now don't have the cash to buy. And an exemption, a tax holiday on the first $20,000 of income from payroll taxes would put money directly into people's pockets immediately and allow them to spend more, and that would in turn create more jobs.
And we're out of time. Thank you so much, Professor Reich, for being with us this hour.
Well, thanks, John.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Robert Rush, professor of public policy at UC Berkeley and former U.S. Secretary of Labor. Chrissy Pease produced this hour of programming. Rhonda Fanning and Rachel Owens handled on-air production. We'll be back after the news.